Quantity is not going to get you anywhere. It's quality. You've got to have some great stuff. You can make a full living with one great song. We know that, right? We know songwriters and artists out there who have made their entire career with one killer song.
That's Zion Brock. I'm Steve Cleveland. This is Sync Club. Hey, Zion. Welcome to the club.
Hey, man. It's good to be here.
You know, you've had an interesting career because I know that you've pivoted, and I'd like to hear a little bit about what got you headed into this space where you're creating music for sync licensing, because I know that you had a regular kind of career started before you got into this creative space.
Yeah, kind of crazy. I started out as an engineer. I got a job as an engineer in college, a degree in aerospace engineering from a school called Embry-Riddle up in Arizona. And I thought for a while that that's what I wanted to do. And I got a job for Honeywell in Phoenix and worked for around 14 years, something like that, for them. Mm-hmm. And did a lot of contract work, doing a lot of avionics and flight controls. And the work is kind of cool. It's kind of interesting. You get to work on planes, you know, and work in simulators and real neat stuff. But very dry environment and not a very creative environment. It's very technical, very left brain. And I have a lot of respect for that field, but it just wasn't me. I never thrived in it. And I'm a huge believer that you will not get good at anything unless you love it. It's really hard to get good at something you don't love. And I just didn't love it. At the time, I was playing drums for churches. I've been a drummer my whole life. And I was really wrapped up in the evangelical Christian, kind of contemporary Christian music scene for a while.
Sure.
And leading worship and playing drums. And there's a huge Vineyard church out here in Phoenix. And I played drums for them for a long time. I had a great time. A lot of fun. So anyway, I guess I'm just saying that my music just constantly was there. It was like this hobby, this thing I loved doing. And when I first got a job, I bought a small computer, my first computer, and bought a Pro Tools rig. No, actually, it was Cakewalk. Do you remember Cakewalk?
My first DAW that I bought, it was in 1995, and I bought Cakewalk Pro, which was, I think, version 5, and it was the first one that you could use unlimited audio. So yeah, I remember, and I could get about 4 tracks with my computer of audio.
Yes. Yes. And do you remember that when MIDI came out with Cakewalk, it didn't even show the notes like in a piano roll. It just had these little dots that indicated, hey, you did something there.
That's all you need to know.
That's all you needed to know. But I saw a friend in Dallas. I'm from Dallas originally, and I had gone home during a summer break after college, and he was, you know, just cranking out songs using a version of Cakewalk, which is now, I think, Sonar. And I just fell in love with it. I had no idea you could do that. I had no idea you could just make your own music. So I bought my first rig in 2001 and just started dabbling with it and was terrible at it. And my whole goal was, hey, I don't want to be a producer. I don't want to produce my own stuff. All I want to do is just take songs that I've written and then just capture it and just play it on the guitar, play it, you know, sing to it so I can convey it to other people. I'm like, how hard could this be, right? And as you know, the more you start getting into it, the more you realize, well, that doesn't sound good. How come that doesn't sound good? It sounded good in my head. Mm-hmm. And you kind of go into this, I don't know, it's like going down this rabbit hole of buying equipment and trying things out and testing stuff. But through that process that I did for like 15 years before I really started taking it seriously, I really culminated a lot of knowledge and information and from other people, as well as gear. I bought a lot of gear that was a waste of money. But I got to a point where I started actually making pretty good music, like started sounding okay, you know?
Yeah.
And I stopped singing because I realized that out of all the gifts I've been given, singing was not one of them. Okay. So I just stopped that. And I just fell in love with the process of writing and then producing. Mm-hmm. And so I joined a buddy of mine here in Phoenix. He and I teamed up, and he actually found me. He said, you're the best songwriter I know in Phoenix. However, all your songs suck because you're writing in the wrong genre. All your songs sound like this smooth jazz kind of thing. And I was like, oh, thanks, I guess. I don't know. So, but he said, you need to start like writing pop music. Like, listen to Top 40 and start writing pop music. And I said, I don't really even listen to that. I was listening to a lot of Coldplay and just sort of well, at the time they weren't even top 40 yet. This is before they really got famous, and just kind of indie stuff and rock stuff. And I was listening to a lot of Christian stuff at the time and country, and just had no real desire to get into the pop top 40. I looked down on it. I was one of those kind of music snobs that looked down on it and go, oh no, you know, that's not real music. That's bubblegum music.
As we all have, I think, you know, and that's a curse because it's good music, actually. It's really well done.
Some of it's the best music ever, in my opinion. I mean, it's for, especially the production part of it. It is incredibly difficult to produce really good top 40 music. It takes the best producers, in my opinion. That's like the playground for great producers. You can get away with not being the greatest producer with, you know, singer-songwriter or folk or country and things like that. But to really be competitive, oh man, there's so much talent in pop music. So I got over myself and started writing in that vein and was like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. This is so much more fun. And there was, you know, I had those moments, I don't know about you, but I had those moments where I felt like, am I compromising who I am and my authenticity? You know, is this really me? I was trying to do some rap stuff and I'm not really a rapper at all. It expanded my thinking and I started thinking outside the box in a way that I'm really, really grateful for now. So yeah, it was just a really cool journey. I teamed up with a girl here in town named Miss Crystal, and she's got a huge following. She's kind of a diva of Phoenix. She's a great artist. And we started doing some stuff together, and we had some big producers that were remixing our stuff and putting it in nightclubs and in New York City. And it was just, there was just a cool moment. There was this amazing momentum through all of it that was a lot of fun. And through all that, I just kept thinking, well, how do I actually make money as a songwriter and in the music world? I love making music. It's like the funnest thing on earth. But how do you actually make money at it so I can get out of my job? And so I had to kind of figure that out.
Sure. I think this is good stuff. But I think what the listeners would like to know is, like, at what point did you sever ties with the corporate job and go out on your own?
Great question. Yeah, I remember specifically, so I would take these long breaks at work, and I worked again at this office, and I would be sitting by myself all day without talking to anybody because my job was just spreadsheets and outsourcing things. And I don't know, I did a lot of testing of software, and I was just so, the environment was just killing me. And I remember taking this long walk through this field near our work, and it's blazing hot. It was during the summer, and I'm like, I cannot do this anymore. It was one of those moments I had where I can like put a stake in the ground and say, that was the moment I said, I can't do this anymore. I've got to get out of this. So within a year, I just got out. I just kind of got out. I actually found a good friend of mine passed away in Houston, and I went to her funeral, and I was flying back on the plane, and I was listening to a podcast, and I heard Kathy Heller's, she was being interviewed on the CD Baby podcast. Okay. And I was like, oh my gosh, I've never even heard of this, the whole thing called Sync. So I immediately got home and I signed up for a class. It was the very first class she had, the first online class she had. I was one of her first students in that class. I think it was just called Six Figure Songwriting. So yeah, I came home from that funeral and I literally just put my notice in and I said, I'm done. And then I kind of had a freak out moment. I'm like, what have I done? And so I got another engineering job at a company called Rockwell Collins out of Iowa and went out there for 2-week training, came back, and I had this another moment where I'm like, what am I doing? I keep doing this. I keep going after safety instead of following where my heart is taking me. So I'm not saying that's for everybody. That is a very hard thing to do, to quit your career, but I quit it completely. And I said, I'm not going to do it ever again because I just wasn't happy there. And that was really scary. Fortunately, I had a rental house at the time that I was able to sell, and that kind of bridged the gap for me for a bit. But I started taking her class and just went full board into it and realized that I needed to change the way I was writing music and needed to really start thinking about how music is being purchased in the sync world through ads and TV and TV shows and movies, and wondering, what are the kind of music, what are the kind of songs, both lyrical themes and directional production directions that need to be implemented in my music to make it actually, to give it legs, to make it go somewhere?
Yeah. Now this is, I think, really good stuff. So could you tell us, like, how do you approach writing for sync?
Yes. Okay. So when I first kind of started getting into sync, I dropped the top 40 stuff for a bit and I got into kind of folky stuff, sort of folk pop. I've always loved country. So it was a nice blend for me. And I'm from Texas originally, and my brothers were super into bluegrass. And so I have this very country foundation. And so it was very easy for me to kind of move into like sort of folky stuff, Mumford and Sons, you know, Lumineers type music. And plus, at the time, I was learning from Kathy Heller, and her stuff was very homespun and very hand clap and ukuleles. So I just went that direction to see, you know, I'm like, how hard can that be? Well, I realized that the market at the time was very saturated with that, and a lot of the industry was moving away from that. They're starting to get out of the ukuleles and hand claps and looking for other things. It had kind of been played. That sound had sort of been played. It's never going to go away. There's still commercials and stuff, you still see that in it, but it sort of had its time. So I had to just accept that and go, okay, I need to start moving away from that. But my first album with sync was all that style of music. Mm-hmm. And but I'm glad I did it, and it got the attention of Kathy, which at the time was big for me. And from that, I started getting the attention of other licensing agents. And so within the first 6 to 9 months, I had about 3 licensing agents starting to pitch my work. And, you know, you have these opportunities where you'll learn about, okay, this company is interested in this song, and you start getting some traction, and then it falls apart at the last minute. So there's a lot of these like ups and downs, which totally sucked. But I just kept sticking with it and putting out more stuff. Last year I put out, and this isn't even probably a lot to a lot of people, but for me it was a lot. I put out 2 small EPs and a single. So I think in total it was like 10 or 11 songs or something like that. But I'm a slow worker. I would rather work all year on 1 great song than put out 100 really bad, mediocre songs. And I know there's a lot of people that say you just need to be writing constantly. I get that, but I don't completely agree with that, respectfully.
I think that it's critical that the quality is there, because there's no such thing as a demo anymore. Everything has a standard, and the standard is kind of like broadcast ready.
Yes, absolutely. And I don't think there's anything wrong if you're just learning your craft. It's great. Like, for instance, I have a class online that me and Josh Doyle, another producer, we have a class called the Triple Threat Artist, where we teach music production. And one of the things we do is encourage our students constantly, you need to be coming up with grooves and making, you know, strides in production every single week. So I'm not against constantly working your craft, but what I am against is trying to write a full song, you know, two full songs a day or something like that. I think that what ends up happening is you don't have the amount of time that's needed to actually saturate yourself in that song to actually make it good. Mm-hmm. And that's just my theory. Maybe it's just the way I work, but I don't resonate with quantity. Quantity is not going to get you anywhere. It's quality. You've got to have some great stuff. You can make a full living with 1 great song. We know that, right? We know songwriters and artists out there who have made their entire career with 1 killer song.
Sure.
They probably had a lot of songs leading up to that. But at the end of the day, you've got to have a great song. And for me, that song has to sort of gestate. It's got to like bake for a while in my brain, in my ears. I've got to listen to it back and go, oh, you know, what I loved yesterday is actually not that great. I need to change that. And let's tweak this here. And you know what? That second verse isn't strong enough. And you know what? Right. This drop right here, it could have a little more impact if we suddenly took that shaker out. Why aren't we taking that shaker? And those are the kinds of things that I can't do in one day. I need time, that iterative process.
Now, do you come to these conclusions on your own, or do you work with other people? Are you getting feedback from other folks?
Well, that's a great question. I am definitely telling you kind of from how I work solo, but everything I do now is collaborative. I don't ever do anything alone anymore. And because I think we have so much more, we can go so much further, and there's a synchronicity thing and a magic that happens when you have multiple people. Plus they help carry the load on things. So if you collaborate with a great somebody that has a lot of connections or somebody that's really good at the administrative part. Now I don't have to do that. I can just focus on the song. I got off the phone today with one of my songwriters that I have worked really well with. Her name's Nancy, and she's an incredible artist, and she's doing things that I don't have to. So on our songs that we're doing, she's expecting me to finish up the production and the mix and the mastering on yada yada. And like, for instance, we have a Christmas song that we're still trying to finish up. That we're a little late this year, but we're going to roll that thing out. And she's the one that's going to be shopping it and pushing it because she's better at that than I am. Okay. Now, I can do it. I've done it and I've had some success at it, but that's not what I love. I would rather work with a collaborator that brings something different to the table. Wouldn't you?
Oh, yeah. I always like to work with other people that either have the connections or the drive to do what I'm not good at.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's fun, too. It gives you a level of joy when you can celebrate with somebody. You know, I mean, I think when I first started, I was like, yeah, but, you know, what if it hits and I won't get all the money? You know, you sort of have these fears that you're going to be splitting any kind of profits with another person. But when you realize the benefits, it far outweighs the negatives, in my opinion. And I love to work with multiple people. So I have a Latin song I'm working on right now with an artist. I've got a jazz song I'm working with an artist on. I've got a rock song I'm working with Mikey Myers on. I've got another folk song coming out with my guy Cameron. So I love having different hands and stuff, but my artistry is still this sort of folk pop. So Fan Fiction is my artistry, and I kind of keep that protected. I don't want my artistry to be 1,000 different genres. I want it to sort of be in one or two different genres, and that's it. And if I end up writing a great Latin song, we'll put it on that Latin artist's album. It doesn't need to be on mine.
Right. Exactly, because as an artist, you want to kind of have a sound.
Yeah, absolutely. And plus, you know, it now is up to her to shop that song and release it on her album and or whatever she's going to do with it. I don't now have to worry about giving that song life. She's taking a lot of that work off, because I don't know about you, but sometimes the easiest part of creating music is actually the creating the music. It's the marketing of the music that I find intimidating and scary sometimes. And I kind of choke up sometimes trying to figure out how to get my music out there and into the right hands.
That's always the thing. You know, you almost want to pair up with somebody if you're creative that is actually kind of better at business or better at networking.
Totally agree.
I've heard where people say, To really make it in this business, you need maybe 3 to 7 really super strong connections with people that can use your music. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah. And, you know, here's what's amazing is I probably am responsible for maybe 3 or 4 licensing agents that pitch my music. And the other 8 licensing agents that pitch my music are because of the connections I have. So because I'm connected to this, you know, artist over here that's shopping a jazz song, she gets our song into this catalog over there or this licensing agent, and then it introduces me to them, and then now I can pitch my other music for that person as well. And I have been just super fortunate in the last year. I went from, you know, about 3 licensing agents that pitch my music to around 12. And that's mainly thanks to my collaborators. It's not even thanks to me. It's like I have these little armies that are working for me, and I didn't even realize the benefit of that until it just sort of happened. I'm like, holy cow, why didn't I do this from the very beginning? This is incredible. And I've done the same thing with other artists. I've worked with, you know, I'll start writing or producing a song for somebody, and they're like, this is awesome. Where can we pitch it? And I'm like, oh, well, let's just go talk over here to Dan. He's got this, or let's go talk to Wendy over here. And I have these connections too. So I've been helping other artists. It's not just a one-way thing. This is a, you know, scratch each other's back kind of thing. Sure. Which is beautiful. And just like, you know, the audience that's listening to this podcast, they're doing such an amazing thing by listening to this because they're making these connections. I really think you cannot survive in this business in a silo or in a vacuum. You have to be constantly networking with other people.
Yeah. Otherwise, you have an audience of maybe your mom and yourself. and nobody else is going to really care because there's just so much music out there. So you have to find a way to get it out there. Now, absolutely. I was going to ask you, do you have any advice or tips for independent artists that are new to this in finding an agency? I mean, how do you connect with some of these people?
You know, what really shifted for me is in the last few years, went to some Sync Keeper events, which are these events that Catch the Moon Music has over in LA. I'm not sure if you ever went to one of those.
I haven't yet. Okay. I hope to this coming year.
Yeah, but cool. It's such a great event. But one of the things that really hit me at the last one I went to, which was back in March, is I was listening to some just incredible music from the students that were there. And I was helping run the conference. So I was, you know, hitting play in the back and letting these music supervisors and licensing agents listen on stage. And they were listening to these artists. And I realized the power shift was completely flip-flopped. Most artists have this feeling that they've got to get in the door. They've got to get this person to know who they are, and maybe I can impress them and buy them a latte or, you know, something like that. And, you know, there's something to be said about that. But if you really look at what's going on in this business, the power is actually in the artist's hand. The power, let me say that again. The power's actually in our hands as artists. It's not in the music supervisors and licensing agents, because those people, you know, music supervisors and licensing agents are doing that job because they can't make the kind of music that we can make. Now, some of them are great musicians also. I'm not trying to throw, I'm not trying to diminish what they're doing at all. We need them and they need us, is my point. And the thing is, when you really start seeing a music supervisor get excited by connecting to an artist, you realize that the power shift needs to be the other way around. You've got to make great music and command respect. And if you're not getting attention, if you're having every once in a while somebody listen to your music and they're not all over you, you're not good enough yet. You're getting paid exactly what you're worth, which is nothing. And I hate to sound harsh, but it's a little bit true. And I learned that from Dave Pensado on the Pensado's Place podcast. It's amazing.
Love that podcast, yes.
Yes, you know him. But he said, you know, if as an audio engineer, if you can't get work, then you're probably getting paid exactly what you deserve. And it's not to be harsh, but it's just you're not good enough yet. When you're good enough, you automatically compete. It just happens.
Yeah.
When your sound is good enough, it just commands respect. It commands attention. And people come to you. And you don't have to work so hard anymore. You don't have to work to get in those doors so hard. They come to you and they say, what else you got? Do you have anything that sounds like this month? I need something that sounds like a Katy Perry song. And it just, like literally, I'm working on another little business right now called Get Known. It's just to help entrepreneurs and stuff. But I'm taking this little break from music just for a couple months. But in this couple months, I'm still getting calls and emails from people saying, hey, we have this song. Do you have anything for this? Do you have anything for this? And I'm not even doing anything. I'm not reaching out to them. They're reaching out to me. And what an awesome position to be in, because then you know what is being needed. You know the connections. When you have the right song, you have those connections already solidified and you can just charge forward and give them your song that you have. You can create an email list. My recommendation in all of this is you've got to get your stuff to sound good. If you're not a producer, you need to learn a little bit of production. Just have to. Because when you go into the studio and you work with somebody and they start talking about a compressor, you need to know what that is.
Yeah.
When they start talking about, hey, what mic works well for your voice, you need to have an answer for that.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't have to know everything about production. You don't have to be an incredible producer. If you are somebody like me and you've been struggling as an artist, originally the way I was struggling, I was trying to sing my own stuff. The best decision I ever made was to stop singing. I'm not that great of a singer. Stop. Just stop. And when I did,
because there are just great vocalists out there. I mean, this is all great advice. So Zion, let me ask you this. I know that you're a busy guy. You've got a lot of things going on. What are you up to now? And is there anything that you'd like to promote?
Oh, very cool. Well, I always love seeing new people come on to the Triple Threat Artist course that we have. It's a community and course. It's just for singer-songwriters that want that extra, you know, a lot of people just go into this business as a singer and songwriter. And we're like, okay, what if you're a singer-songwriter producer, a triple threat? That's where the name came from. And we love teaching people about that. So if you guys have any interest in that, we are available. We like to also give little webinars and free stuff away. So just come sign up. I can give you my, you know, a good address to go to or whatever.
Do you want to mention it now?
I think just go to thetriplethreatartist.com. There's a free download. It's a PDF download where you can, it's like a, I call it the Red Zone production timeline. It's just a timeline of things you need to think about. And I just give it away for free. And I put a lot of thought and a lot of work into it and how I produce music. And I would love to send you great information if you're interested. And if you have any interest in the course, let us know.
Well, hey, that's fantastic. Zion, thank you so much for joining us today.
Absolutely.
That was just some really great information.
Yeah, I appreciate it, man. Thanks.
This is Steve Cleveland, and you've been listening to Scene Club. If you enjoyed this podcast, make sure you check out our show notes, where you can find additional information and links regarding our guest. Let us know what you'd like to hear about. Hit us up on Twitter, username Sync Club Podcast. Thanks for the hang. We'll see you here next week at the club.